This is the March 2010 edition of Linux Journal Live. I'm Sean Powers. The other guy is Kyle Rankin, and we're going to tell you about the system administration issue. So, what's going on in your life, Kyle?
Well, you know, before we get too much into this issue, I think, you know, since both of us are sysadmin, we may actually have a little bit more to say about this issue than, for example, the HAM issue, which was all sort of news, I think, to both of us. So,
right.
Since both of us do this for a living, as far as me, I've had a pretty basic, normal, unexciting life. How about you, Sean?
Yeah, well, you know, things have been going good. I mean, house burned down. That part wasn't so good. But no, seriously, yeah, my house burned down. And it had nothing to do with the way I administer my servers. I just want that to be clear. My servers were on the opposite end of the house to the fire. So
yeah, no weird racks of servers plugged in all to the same plug or anything like that?
No, it's not like one of those National Lampoon Christmas Vacation plugs, you know? Have you seen that? Or they're all plugged in?
Oh, yeah.
Okay. Thank you for, even if you didn't, thank you for lying. And, oh, yeah, I know what you're talking about, Sean.
Oh, yeah, I mean, you know, every time you say, yeah, I know exactly what you're saying, yeah.
So, no, it's been an interesting week, but I'm here with computer and microphone on my head, and we're doing this up. Now, I can't promise that it's going to be edited as well. So, Kyle, I have a recording of you singing the intro music that I might just leave on there if I can't get the intro music to mix just right. So.
Oh, perfect. That's going to sound great, yeah.
Yeah.
I just want to say, like, Sean is a trooper because this is, like, 1 week into this, and this is on a brand-new computer, a brand-new everything. I wasn't expecting to do this month, and Sean's just like, oh, yeah, well, of course I'm going to do it on time. Yeah, so.
Well, the secret is, well, thank you, but the secret is I have no other distractions. I mean, I have no things. I have nothing. I'm wearing my wife's pink robe, and because it's cold and I have nothing else to wear.
That's too much information.
Yeah, be thankful it's not a video podcast. So anyway, we do have a great issue this month, and it's one that, yes, you and I are very familiar with because this is what we do on a daily basis. I did learn some things. For example, the first article I'm going to talk about is by Der Hans. Now, I have to admit, now this is interesting, I don't know exactly this person's name. I have never met the author, but it's Der.Hans, and I totally want a dot in my name. And I don't just mean after the mister.
I totally want, like, an article in my name, like, even, like, the Kyle, I think, would be awesome.
Okay. I have a zero in my last name on some of my online personas. That's rather interesting. But anyway, he tells us about SSH, which we all use. Now, I know a system administrator that still uses Telnet. He insists that it's encrypted Telnet, so it's fine, but it still gives me the willies. It really does. But, yeah, SSH, obviously, we all use. But he talks about going through an untrusted host, possibly even a compromised host, with SSH, because, of course, it's all encrypted. And I don't, you know, it's a circumstance that you can, if you're somewhere far away, you know, a non-trusted host is definitely a possibility. Going through a compromised host is just creepy on a lot of levels.
Yeah, I thought that was, I mean, it's kind of creepy, and for me, it's good that he talks about how to do something like this. I would be so nervous about being on there, period, and not just unplugging the thing. But I can see, like, this particular article, I can see not only being useful for that circumstance, but you can take the same methods that he's using to tunnel through that machine and tunnel through pretty much any machine that allows SSH tunneling. So say, you know, it's really easy to get a shell account online with either friends or just there's a lot of shell services, and you can use this same exact feature to tunnel through that.
Right, whereas it wouldn't be a compromised host. It just wouldn't be necessarily something that you trust your data to, if that makes any sense. You want it encrypted still.
Right.
So it's a great way to get from here to there, and truly being in a tunnel, I guess. So.
No, I'll be honest. I've even used the method he's talking about. I've even used it myself when I have one particular host that firewall rules have allowed it to talk to, let's say, host A and host B, but host A and B can't talk to each other.
Yes, I know exactly what you mean. IP tables, darn you.
Yes, but I have to copy a file from host A to host B, and I want to, or not just one file, but I have to, like, sync a bunch of files. So I've been known to set up a tunnel sort of like that and then do an S copy through that tunnel just so that I can do it really fast.
That's actually really, yeah, that's a good idea. That's a great idea. So what do you have for us?
All right, well, following along with the idea of security, the one that I'm talking about is an article titled Alien Vault, The Future of Security Information Management, and it's by Jeremiah Bowling. And basically this article is talking about this type of software called an OSSIM, or I like to pronounce it awesome myself.
Yeah, me too. That's pretty good.
So it's an awesome, which, I mean, by itself, you'd want to install something called awesome anyway. But what it looks, basically what it talks about is it's sort of like a Nagios-like system. You can think of this sort of like Nagios for security management. So, you know, Nagios will check whether your load is too high or whether you have using too much memory or that sort of thing and alert you. And this software will basically scan your hosts and let you know and log any interesting security problems that you may have. And it provides a nice little graphical view. It looks like it has some nice Nagios implementation involved in it as well. And it just provides like a nice little GUI. In fact, it looks like it borrows quite a bit from Nagios, or at least integrates Nagios into it. And you can use it to keep track of whether or not any of your software has, you know, rootkits installed on it or that sort of thing. So it's a good way to add an extra level of security management to your systems.
Cool. Now, I have to admit, I don't use Nagios as much as I should. What a great segue. That was an accidental segue into my article talking about using SMS texting with Nagios. Basically, now there's it's talking about setting up Nagios to... Now, how do you say it? Do you say Nagios?
I say, you probably should say Nagios. I always say Nagios, but I think Nagios is right because I think the creator mentioned that he named it that way because it's supposed to nag you.
Okay, because I've also heard Nagios, and that just doesn't sound right at all. But, you know, soda.
Or maybe like, Najwa.
Najwa. Yes, so this article on Najwa, gosh, you're doing good tonight, Kyle. You're on the ball. You're burning down the house. Is it too soon?
Well, it's a little too soon.
It's too soon. Okay. Sorry. Anyway.
I'm on fire.
Yeah. I'm offended. Anyway. it's talking about integrating SMS services with Nagios. And that works really great because now you use Nagios at work, but you were telling me before the show that you don't necessarily have SMS set up. That's correct, right?
Yeah, you're not exactly. What we do is, you know, Nagios alerts us through email, but we have in mind the fact that, well, you know, all of our email ultimately goes through a single server somewhere, or even if it goes through a couple different servers, it may be in a different data center, or there may be some problem, so we don't want our alerting to be completely dependent on one mail server, because what if that mail server goes down, then you don't have any alerting. So, you know, we'll do things like we use BlackBerries, and BlackBerries end up having their own email address that goes through BlackBerry servers. So what we do is we have alerts go both through our regular mail system to our regular address and then go through our BlackBerry address as well. So if one or the other is down, we still get alerts. But, you know, another thing we do is we have Nagios servers poll each other. So, you know, in case the whole data center's down, you know, we have another server that's they're checking each other basically to make sure they're up.
Right, that's a good idea. And I like the way I like to have more than one solution. Like you said, what if your email server goes down, that kind of thing. It's great to have multiple things, although it does nag you more when you get more false positives. But nonetheless, I think this is great. It talks about setting up an SMS server. And the other problem that you have to be careful of, where I live, for example, in the rental house we're in right now, I have zero cell phone coverage. So
right.
That, you know, if SMS is the way you're getting notified, it's not so great. But if it's in addition to other notification methods, it's awesome.
Well, and the other thing he mentions is how to also use an SMS reply. The scripts he's talking about have an extra script that allow you to easily acknowledge any of your alerts through SMS. And as someone who gets paged sometimes in the middle of the night when you're half asleep, but you know, for example, it's a false positive.
Right.
It's really handy to be – and you know, for example, if you know a service is flapping or, you know, yeah, that's my backup job, and in 2 minutes it's not the load's not going to be high anymore – and I don't want it to page me anymore. You can this article tells you how to send an SMS reply back that will acknowledge the alert, and so it doesn't bother you anymore.
Right. It's not just alerting; it's a two-way communication.
Right. Which is really valuable. Like I said, if you if you get paged at night, especially, it's really handy.
And it also means that there's hope for the teenagers in the world that they can be system administrators in the future because they can text so fast.
Right, yeah. I have a feeling, you know, like a couple of generations down the line, we're going to have people with gigantic thumbs and, like, no fingers.
Ooh, being all thumbs will be a positive attribute.
Right, yeah, it's going to be like a advantage in system admin, yeah.
Nice. So it'll help them tame the beast.
Yeah, well, their thumbs will be beasts. And another excellent segue to another article that's in this issue called Taming the Beast by Jason Allen. And actually, I really enjoyed this article in particular because he talks about as you're scaling to a lot of machines and, you know, what's a lot of machines. But he's talking about if you're getting to hundreds or thousands of machines, that the way that you manage your systems is different than if you're only managing, you know, 5, 10, 20, 30 machines. And he starts talking about what his experience and what he's found really makes it easy to manage such large scales of machines. And as someone myself, I manage quite a few, you know, large number of machines myself, and I found myself learning quite a bit, you know, and getting some really good tips from this article. So, for instance, he talks about, you know, when you're setting up something like Nagios or Najwa, that what you need to do is, you know, not alert on everything, that, you know, you don't want too many either false positives or you don't want to even be alerted on things that you don't have that aren't directly actionable. That when you have, like, say, 1,000 systems, if they're all alerting you because of a warning because their RAM might be getting used up, but there's nothing you can really do about it yet, that it's not worth alerting. So there's a lot of just practical common sense things in this article that can help you as you start getting to a lot of servers. Because I know, you know, when I first started myself managing servers for a small operation, my monitoring system was I only had like 5 servers, so my monitoring system was having gKrelum launched 5 times on a desktop.
Yep.
You know,
and that's
and
you know, we bring a lot of we bring different things to the table in that you do manage a lot of very similar servers. Is that true? A lot of them do similar things.
Right, they do a lot of similar things, and they're identical. You know, too. So, and that's something else he brings up in the article is that if you're managing a lot of servers and you don't have a huge staff, it really makes sense to make them as identical as possible, both software and hardware.
Right. Now, for me, I manage far, far fewer servers. However, every server pretty much does its own thing. And so that, you know, it's a whole different thing. But, you know, I can have, you know, 5 instances of jKrelum on my desktop and actually, you know, manage most of my servers. But it is, and there's that threshold where, you know, it's where you can no longer just log into a bunch of different computers and check things out. You know, like, and this article really does talk about things past the threshold. Like you're talking about where you have to be able to manage many things at once without individually, you know, accessing each one of them and that kind of thing.
Right, and things start to become certain things that used to be really important when you have 5 servers or things that didn't seem to be a big deal then really start to matter as you get to a couple hundred or 1,000 machines.
Right.
But, you know, it's a case of, you know, big environments versus small environments. Now, you know, speaking of small environments, we should, you know, we should actually dig into our mailbag.
I think we should rename our show. I think we should call it the Segway Show. You know, and like, and then we should drive around in a little Segway like things. Because, yes, what a great segue, Kyle. This letter is from, I didn't copy and paste.
It's from Greg Ballendonk, actually.
Okay, there we go. And it says, I'm surprised I don't see Linux alternatives to a Mac Mini. The alternative hardware needs seem to be small and quiet, like a Mac Mini. Hardware suppliers like Logic Supply and Polywell have a dizzying selection of hardware, but the cost is more than $1,000. Why isn't there a selection of Linux Mini alternatives equal or better than a Mac Mini at competitive prices? For reference, a $600 Mac Mini features a 2.6 GHz Intel Core 2 Duo, 2 GB of DDR3S DRAM, 160 gigs hard drive, gigabit Ethernet, 8X double layer super drive, NVIDIA GeForce 9400M, dual video ports, USB and FireWire, Snow Leopard, and 14 watts power at idle. So why Kyle? Why aren't you selling computers?
Well, for a couple of reasons, but I, you know, I was surprised that Greg didn't bring up the shuttle, a lot of the shuttle PCs. Now, it's true that there may not be quite as many machines that have Linux already pre-installed and set up, but that's true in a lot of cases. But I think there's a lot of alternatives to the Mac Mini in the shuttle. Now, it may not have as round of corners, and it may not look exactly the same. It may not have the same kind of toaster DVD ejecting qualities that the Mac Mini has. But there's quite a few little, if you're talking about just a small but pretty powerful, fairly quiet machine, there's a lot of, like I said, Shuttle is the one that comes to mind, but there's a lot of sort of lower cost providers that have like the mini ITX boards and like a really small footprint, some of them built to be quiet computers that you can use. Like, for example, I use one, it's not exactly Mac Mini size, but I use one for my media PC. I have a small, just one of those slim profile PCs. So it's bigger than a Mac Mini, but all the same, it's really inexpensive and it's reasonably quiet as well. And I use that for, Xbox Media Center.
Right
on my TV.
In the magazine, I actually replied, and one of my thoughts is that there may not be a really huge demand for that. I mean, when you look at a Mac Mini, I'm an OS X user at work, and before the fire, I had a laptop that was a Macintosh, and I think the Mac Mini is actually for people who really, really want to have a Mac but can't afford it, as sad as that sounds. And I think with Linux, there are a lot of other low-power options, like a smaller laptop, or just not necessarily smaller form-wise, but, a smaller in-price laptop that is going to do all the things a comparable desktop would do and be even more portable. So I think maybe that's one of the reasons.
Yeah, and I mean, like I said, there's just so many – there. I think there are a lot of – choices out there. It may not be, for example, like your local, big box electronics store that may not have a lot of choices. But, where I am, there's a lot of Fry's stores, and I would say 4, 5, 6 different choices, maybe more, of small form factor, reasonably powerful machines that don't seem to use too much power.
And you know what? Maybe it's that they're not boxed as Linux machines. Maybe that's they're usually running Windows 7 Starter or whatever I don't even know how the Windows world works, but some low end Windows thing. I guess maybe they're not being sold that way. But yeah, the small form factors computers exist, so maybe it's just a build your own kind of thing.
Yeah, maybe that's what it is. I mean, to me personally, I think there's more options. Again, maybe not as slick as the Mac Mini, if that's what you like. But then again, I think you can probably get a nice little Linux install on a Mac Mini, too.
Right.
So you could always just do that.
That's very true. It's very true. And they are, Mac Minis are pretty cool looking. They do a nice job. But, hey, I don't want to...
Actually, speaking of Macs, whenever I think of Macs, I always think about Bill, actually.
That segue crashed a little bit.
Oh, no, it didn't crash, because you have to know Bill. It's an inside segue, okay. So I get it huge, and no one else is going to get it. But he seems to love, even though he's a huge Linux guy, he's one of the only huge Linux guys I know that just loves Apple stuff, too.
Really? So do you think he's going to get an iPad?
I think he'll get an iPad. I think he's going to sit there with a stack. I want to see his stack of iPad with his iPhone on top of it, with his iPod on top of that. All of that on top of his MacBook.
Maybe if he stacks it up enough, it'll go all the way to the clouds.
Now, that's a good segue.
I thank you. Because this month Bill talks about setting up an Ubuntu instance in the Amazon cloud. And I just wanted to mention it to pick on him because cloud computing is one of my pet peeves. And I'm probably, half of our vendors just gasped. I don't think there's anything wrong with it. I just... it's people tease me about cloud computing all the time. How do you feel about cloud computing, Kyle?
See, I mean, I was doing, I guess, what a lot of people are calling cloud computing, but it wasn't called a cloud yet. Bill and I actually set up something ourselves, which was just a huge, very dense cluster of virtual machines where you could spin up new virtual machines really quickly and add them to your environment. But this is before they called it cloud anything. So, I mean, I guess nowadays they would call that a private cloud.
I think that's what gets me. It's, it's not like this completely new concept that's been invented. It's just a new buzzword. that's really what it is about it. But you guys have a great argument this month. and I want to weigh in on it. So.
Oh, perfect. Yeah, I actually don't know what you're going to say about this, so I'm actually eagerly anticipating your stance on this.
All right, you guys are arguing over /user/local versus the /opt directory. Where should programs go that you install? And now, which side do you take? You're the fan of what?
Now, I'm the user local guy.
Okay.
And Bill, because I think his history at working at Sun, he has a soft spot for opt.
Yeah, it could be. Now, see, in my brain, each are separate and have their own thing. Like, if you're going to write something like a bash script that, you know, you just use and so you make it a program, that definitely goes in user local bin. I mean, that's just its spot. If you have a weird proprietary software package, you know, that probably you didn't have source or part of it came pre-compiled as a binary, in my head, that goes in the opt directory because it's kind of like where the ugly stepchild software goes. Now, I say that, and of course, LTSP installs in the opt directory, and I just love LTSP. But in my brain, that's kind of like what happens. The opt directory is, like, dirty. I don't want it in my user directory. So, yeah.
Well, that makes sense. Yeah, I think opt is dirty as well. So, at least on that, we can agree, I guess.
So if you put Microsoft Office 2007 on your Linux machine, it would go in opt.
It would probably want to go under opt if it had a choice, because it would want to do it. Microsoft would want to do it the wrong way, so they would probably want to put it under opt.
And you would probably want it to go under dev null, right?
Yeah.
All right. Hey, thanks, Kyle. I appreciate this. I'm actually sitting in a recliner with a laptop on my lap instead of my normal recording rig, so my apologies to everybody if this turns out horrible and you can barely hear us talking, but I think it's recording. So, do you want to sing the outro music in case I can't get that going again?
I think that I'm going to leave that to you.
You're not going to do the... That's okay. I'll just copy and paste you from the beginning.
Awesome.
All right, we'll talk to everybody next month. I hope that you enjoy this system administrator issue. I used to have a blurb that I was supposed to read, and I don't have it now because it's on my computer in my home, which smells like smoked Gouda now. So not Gouda. It smells horrible. But this issue should be on newsstands in a week or two, something like that. And if you're a subscriber, you should be getting it any day now. Is that how it goes? I think that's about right.
That sounds good to me.
And if not, I made that up, and, you know, and Carly will be upset at me for lying to everybody. But anyway, have a good day. And this is Sean saying I'll see you later.
And this is Kyle saying, okay, cut.
I'm gonna leave that in. Well, let's just ride our segues off into the sunset.
Awesome.
All right. Bye.